days while a doctor investigated the state of her mind. She was found sane and sentenced to a month's hard labour. Because of the coal shortages caused by the miners' strike, only half of the trains were running, but Robert and Charles Pike managed to make their way by rail through London to Essex. The Salvation Army farm colony at Hadley overlooked the Thames estuary a few miles from Southend. It sat on a hilltop by the ruin of a 13th-century castle, above a scrubby foreshore piled with cockle shells. The sharp winds from the river and sea carried a salty reek of fish and algae. The Essex clay was springy and sticky underfoot. At the colony headquarters, Pike gave Robert into the care of the Salvation Army officers and then headed back to Broadmoor. The Salvation Army had been founded in East London in 1865 by the self-styled General William Booth and his wife Catherine. It was an evangelical working-class Christian movement that focused on social reform. During Robert's childhood, Sally Army bands had paraded the streets of West Ham with their drums and trumpets, blasting out the joy of salvation, while the army missions offered practical help to the poor. Booth had established the colony on the Essex Badlands in 1891 in the hope that it would help to solve two apparent problems of the day: the fragility of the overstretched empire and the physical decline of the urban working class. In 1910, the novelist Henry Rider Haggard explained in his book, Regeneration, that as Booth had become acquainted with the histories of the destitute men on the streets of London, he realized how closely a great proportion of human sin is connected with wretched surroundings. To attempt not only the regeneration of the individual, but also of his circumstances, Booth proposed to take wrecked men out of the urban slums, restore them to health and productivity, and then ship them out to people the wilds of Canada and New Zealand. In this way, the teeming city would be relieved of its tramps and wastrels, and the empty imperial outposts filled up with fresh colonists. Booth's project gained extra urgency in the wake of the Boer War. In 1899, it had emerged that 8,000 of the 11,000 Mancunians who volunteered for service in South Africa were so physically feeble as to be unfit for service. "Back again to the garden," urged the general. About 200 men were living in the Hadley colony in 1912, many of them derelict alcoholics picked up from the streets of London. All were unemployed. "We came down in a farm wagon," recalled one colonist, "half a dozen lads from the train. And there it was, smooth in the morning light, and the castle standing on the highest part like it was watching still over the fields. I was going to stay here. No foggy smoke, no screeching noise, and no more shivering and standing idle in the bitter wind and rain and sleet at a dockyard gate." Most of the residents were eventually discharged to paid work or to a colony overseas. Within a fortnight of Robert's arrival, 42 men, almost a quarter of the Hadley population, were dispatched to Canada. At Hadley, Robert slowly accustomed himself to a degree of freedom. There were no locks or bolts on the bedroom doors, no walls around the estate. He worked again in a tailor shop on the main parade of buildings along the dirt track known as Castle Avenue. Other colonists made bricks, grew fruit, or tended the colony's poultry. Several million bricks, marked with the initials SALIC, Salvation Army Land and Industrial Colony, were carried by barge to London each year. The Bricks One site produced a red wire-cut brick suitable for bridge and sewer building. Bricks Two turned out the yellow brick that was used in ordinary terraces such as Cave Road. And the kilns of Bricks Three fired a superior red brick, suitable for the construction of villas. The extensive market gardens grew mint for sale in London and rhubarb for Southend. The tomato houses and orchards produced tons of fruit for local markets. The poultry were the pride of the colony. Hadley's fancy fowl often won prizes in national competitions. As at Broadmoor, most of the men also farmed their own allotments, which was considered good training for those who would emigrate and live off the land. General Booth's emphasis on the garden had a moral charge. To tend to a plot implied a taming of one's own nature, a process of self-civilization exemplified in Francis Hodgson Burnett's novel The Secret Garden, 1911, in which the renewal of a wild and ruined garden transforms a sour girl and a hysterical boy into loving, fit, and happy children. Religious services were held in a corrugated iron hall on Castle Avenue, known as the Citadel. These could be intense and noisy events, especially when a colonist experienced a revelation and knelt at the Citadel's wooden seat to repent his sins and pledge himself to God. The atmosphere owed more to the exuberant, heady spirit of the music hall than to the restrained rituals of the Anglican Church. General Booth liked to cite Psalm 98. "With trumpets and sound of cornet, make a joyful noise before the Lord the King." More than 50 musicians played with the Hadley Colony's renowned brass band. To begin with, Robert was provided only with basic board and lodging, but he was soon rewarded for his work with tokens to spend within the colony, and later with a few shillings pay a week. In the summer of 1912, he wrote to the chief steward at Broadmoor to request that he forward him some of the credit that he still held at the asylum. 5 shillings were sent to Robert in June, another 15 in July. Robert's bedding and dining arrangements improved over time. The seaweed mattress and rough covers with which he was first issued were replaced with a firmer mattress and softer blankets. He was promoted from the first section of the refreshment rooms, where he sat at a bench at a bare table and fetched his food from a bar, to the second section, where he was served by a waiter, and then to a third, in which he sat on a chair at a table dressed with a white cloth and was brought thinly sliced meat on white crockery. The longer-standing residents of Hadley were moved from dormitories to individual rooms in one of the colony's farmhouses. By June 1912, Robert had been given a room in Castle House, an 18th-century building overlooking the castle ruins. He could see the tall chimney of Southend Electric Power Station to the east, where the Thames opened into the sea, and the long stretch of Southend Pier. After Emily Coombs's murder, Robert's father had moved out of the house at Cave Road and taken lodgings in the Barking Road. He was back at work on the SS France within weeks of the Old Bailey trial, but on his return from New York in November, found time to visit his son in Broadmoor. The next year, the National Line sold both the France and the England, as Coombs had feared, and he had to find work as a steward with other companies. In 1903, he married a 23-year-old barmaid called Ada White, a dock foreman's daughter who worked in the Ordnance Arms pub in the Barking Road. In the summer of 1912, she fell ill with pneumonia while he was at sea. She died in their house in East Ham in July, with one of her husband's sisters at her side. John Fox returned to anonymity after his acquittal and seems to have died or emigrated by the end of the century. His friend and protector John Lawrence died in 1898 in a vast new lunatic asylum in Woodford, Essex. Fox and Robert's solicitor, Charlie Sharman, was declared bankrupt in 1896, and he was suspended from practice when it emerged that he had been stealing from his clients. The next year he was charged with sexually assaulting another of his clerks. The case was heard by his friend, Ernest Baggerly, who immediately dismissed it. By 1912, Sharman was again working as a lawyer. He subsequently developed a sideline in organized crime, selling stolen bonds on behalf of an international gang of mailbag thieves. Both of Robert's grandmothers had died by 1912, Mary Coombs in Bow in 1900, leaving about £1,000 to be shared between her 5 children, and Tryphena Allen in Liverpool in 1904. Robert's aunt Emily had been widowed, while his uncle Frederick, who had accompanied him on the voyage to New York, had married, had a child, and set up as a grocer in Clerkenwell. Robert's aunt, Mary Macy, who had taken charge of Natty, was still living in Liverpool. Her husband had died in a home for retired seamen in Staten Island, New York, and two of her five children had emigrated to Australia. There is no record of whether Natty visited Robert in Broadmoor, and Natty's job, like his father's, had made it impossible for him to offer to look after Robert upon his discharge. But the brothers met after Robert left the asylum. Natty remained the smaller of the two. He stood at 5 feet 2 inches, while Robert had grown to just over 5 feet 7 inches tall. Natty's hair had darkened to black, and his eyes to grey, whereas Robert's hair was still brown and his eyes blue. Natty had become a ship stoker, first with the Merchant Navy sailing between England and Australia, and from 1904 with the Royal Navy sailing with the Home Fleet from Chatham in Kent. Stokers performed the most grueling of shipboard duties, tending to the fires and furnaces that powered a steamer's engine. "The stoker was the lowest class of sailorman," reported Robert McRae in The Night Side of London. "His work brutalizes him. The heat in the interior of the steamboats drives him mad." The stokehole that contained the furnaces was hot, shiny, slick with oil. Its cranks whirled and its pumps pulsed to propel the shafts that turned the ship's screws. The stokers, stripped to the waist, black with coal, a film of pale ash sticking to their sweat-beaded skin, averted their heads from the spit and flare of fire and steam as they opened the furnace doors. Their hands blistered in the heat. Their eyes tingled and smarted. By 1912, Natty had been scarred above his left eyebrow and on the back of his right forearm. "The stokers come and go in the blazing light and half-gloom," observed the authors of Ocean Steamships, "like nightmares from fantastic tales of demonology." In June 1913, Robert and Natty's twice-widowed father fell ill on board the Rossano, the cargo ship on which he was serving as chief steward. He was put ashore on 2 July at Puerto de la Luz, a coaling port on the island of Las Palmas, off the Atlantic coast of Africa, and was admitted to the town's Queen Victoria Hospital. On 6 July, the day before his 69th birthday, he died of cancer. Natty was halfway across the Atlantic in July 1913. He had been lent by the Royal Navy to the recently established Royal Australian Navy in January, and in June had been appointed to serve as a leading stoker on its flagship, the HMAS Australia. The Australia was a giant battlecruiser that consumed coal at a tremendous rate. To run her at full speed, 50 stokers had to keep feeding the furnaces hard. When she stopped to refuel at the Caribbean island of St. Vincent on her maiden voyage that August, it took 20 hours for the whole crew to load 2,000 tons of coal through manholes in the deck. "I have been down many coal mines," remarked the ship's padre after visiting the stokehole, "and preached considerable about hell, but I never saw anything equal to this yet." The ship reached Sydney in September, and in October 1913 led the fledgling Australian fleet in a ceremonial procession into the harbour. The largest warship in the Southern Hemisphere, the Australia toured the country for the next few months, being greeted with excitement wherever she docked. The coming of the Australian fleet was hailed by the Defence Minister as the most memorable event in the continent's history since the arrival of Captain Cook. A week after Natty reached Sydney, Robert travelled from Hadley to the probate office in London to execute his father's will. Because their stepmother had died, he and Natty were the heirs to the £186 in the estate. Though not rich, they were now men of moderate means. Back at Hadley, Robert got permission to leave the colony and follow Natty to the Antipodes. He sailed on 2 January 1914 from Gravesend in Kent, on the Royal Mail steamer Otranto, as one of about 400 third-class passengers. When asked for his next of kin, he provided the name and address of Charles Pike, the master tailor and supervisor at Broadmoor. He gave his own occupation as tailor. This was the first sea voyage that Robert had made since his trip to New York with his father when he was 13. The ship steamed down the widening reaches of the river, the Essex marshes falling away to the left, the Kentish hills to the right. She sailed out to the Atlantic, and then into the Mediterranean, stopping to collect and deposit mail and passengers at Gibraltar, off the Spanish coast, at Toulon, in France, at Taranto, in Italy, and at Port Said, in Egypt, before passing through the Suez Canal to the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean. At Colombo, in Ceylon, a touring Australian cricket team boarded the vessel for the last leg of the voyage. Passengers of all classes played sports and games on deck and attended a fancy dress ball. After 6 weeks at sea, Robert disembarked in Sydney. The city was the capital of New South Wales, one of the six Australian territories that in 1901 had joined together as a Commonwealth of Federated States. Since federation, some 400,000 Britons had emigrated to Australia, swelling its population to almost 5 million. Natty had lodgings in Newcastle, 100 miles north of Sydney. Robert took the train 550 miles southwest to Melbourne in Victoria. He found work there as a clerk. Chapter 17. Such a Hell of a Noise. When war broke out in August 1914, the Australian Prime Minister promised Britain an army of 20,000. "While the Empire is at war," he said, "so is Australia." By the time that Robert Coombs had travelled back up to Sydney from Melbourne to volunteer for service, the number of soldiers in the new Australian Imperial Force had already exceeded the total that the Prime Minister had pledged. About a quarter of the men in the AIF were British-born. The army offered Robert a form of stability. After 9 months of civilian life, he regained the structures and certainties of an institution, and the pay was good. Australian privates earned 6 shillings a day, more than any other Allied troops. They were sometimes referred to by the British, who earned a single shilling a day, as the six-bob tourists. The coming of war also gave Robert a chance to embark on the voyages of adventure of which he had dreamt as a boy. Over the last 3 months of 1914, Robert trained in a series of camps in southeastern Australia, taking part in parades, drills, route marches, physical jerks for up to 16 hours a day. He was taught to turn in formation, to stand to attention, to form fours. In the absence of uniform, he and his fellow soldiers drilled in shirt sleeves or singlets, dungarees and white hats. They slept 23 to a 10-man tent. The diet, everywhere, was meat stew, bread and jam. Robert was assigned to the 13th Battalion, which was composed mostly of men from New South Wales, and was one of 4 battalions in the 4th Infantry Brigade. Though the men of the 13th were a various lot, among them accountants and labourers, bushmen and clergymen, they gained a reputation as sturdy, independent types, strapping country lads with a breezy disdain for authority. In the battalion of big men, Robert cut a slight figure. He weighed a little over 11 stone, and his chest measured 34 inches, the minimum required in the early days of the war. He needed spectacles to correct the vision in his left eye. At 32, he was older than most of his comrades, but having spent so long in Broadmoor, he was also far less worldly. He had acquired a reserved, educated manner among the gentlemen lunatics of Block 2. He knew little of drink or money, and in 2 decades had barely spoken to a woman. When the uniform for the extra troops arrived, Robert was issued with boots, puttees, cord breeches, a grey collarless shirt made of merino wool, a loose khaki jacket, and a felt slouch hat, its brim turned up on one side. Each tip of the jacket collar was adorned with a badge of a rising sun, the emblem of the AIF. In October, the 13th New South Wales Battalion formed a military band. Since there were no official bands in the AIF, the unit had to obtain its own instruments and sheet music, and to draw musicians from the ranks. The 13th was lucky. A Miss Margaret Harris of Sydney donated the instruments, and the commanders were able to find good performers among the troops. Robert was one of about 25 men selected from the 900 or so in the battalion. He was provided with a cornet, the instrument that usually carried the main melody in a military band piece. It could produce a rich, mellow sound, warmer, rounder, and more lyrical than the piercing bright notes of the trumpet. On 22 December, the band marched through Melbourne at the head of the 13th and played the battalion on to the HMAT Ulysses, the flagship of a fleet carrying some 12,000 Australian and New Zealand soldiers to war. During the six-week voyage to the training camps in Egypt, the band rehearsed daily. On the troop deck, or in the officers' mess each evening, it played ragtime tunes, British Army staples such as It's a Long, Long Way to Tipperary, and waltzes such as Dancing by the Moon and Pink Lady. A favourite number was Australia Will Be There, a new song that both promised the nation's allegiance to Britain and asserted its independent identity. The bandmaster had arranged for the music to be printed just before the Ulysses sailed, and the battalion band popularized the anthem throughout the AIF. "Our band is improving wonderfully," Private Byron Hobson of the 13th Battalion confided to his diary. "The band played on our troop deck last night," he wrote on New Year's Eve, "and we had a fine time ragging and dancing. I have never heard such a hell of a noise before." The regime on the Ulysses was relaxed and the atmosphere irreverent. The soldiers wore dungarees, padded about barefoot, sunbathed, read books, played cards and chess. To while away the days at sea, the 13th and the 14th, a sister battalion raised in Queensland, held a bun-eating competition, a cricket match, won by Robert's battalion team, and a blind boxing match, a bloody affair also won by the 13th. Yet the passage was slow and the diet of stew monotonous, and though Robert was used to a circumscribed life, some of his companions rebelled against the constraints. When the ship docked near Colombo in mid-January, a group of men, mostly of the 14th Battalion, escaped into town on small craft, got deliriously drunk, and ran naked through the streets mauling women. Back on board, the language became so blue as the weeks passed that the minister warned the troops that they would be ostracized from polite society if they persisted in using the Australian adjective, bloody. In another sermon, he reflected aloud on how man lived from moment to moment, not knowing what the next day would bring. "Stew!" hollered the congregation. Even the music had started to grate on some. "I only realized tonight what getting too much of a good thing meant," reported the 19-year-old Private Eric Sussman on 25 January, after a very hot afternoon on the Red Sea. "We have all been interested in our brass band and have listened to it day by day and have appreciated its continuing proficiency. But now the continual blare is becoming boring and nerve-wracking. We get too much of it, too many marches and patriotic selections. Anything for a comic opera selection or a tango dance played by a string band." When the Ulysses sailed through the Suez Canal at the end of the month, the troops lining the banks greeted the new arrivals with cheers. The Australians yelled back, "Do you want some stew?" They disembarked in Alexandria on 1 February 1915 and took the train to Cairo. From there, the men marched the last 3 miles to the camp at Heliopolis. The band's clarinets, trumpets, euphoniums, bassoons, tubas, bugles, cornets, cymbals and drums were transported by truck. The presence of the Australians was designed to discourage any local dissent in Egypt, which the British had declared a protectorate in December. The 13th trained hard in the hot dust and sand, engaging in sham fights, drills, night manoeuvres, trench digging, 20-mile marches through the desert. "Egypt was bum, very bum," concluded Private Sussman. "Hell with the lid on." The men complained among themselves about the incompetence of their officers, particularly their commander, Colonel Granville John Burnage, whom they dubbed Granny, and his stiff, rule-bound sidekick, Major Walter Ellis. The soldiers bought drugged cigarettes and embroidered sateen souvenirs in the Cairo bazaars, and paid for sex in the brothels. Outside the city, they climbed pyramids and rode donkeys and camels, pursued by street vendors who cried out, "Eggs a cook!" as they pulled boiled eggs from the folds in their gowns. The soldiers were strange and comical to the Egyptians, too, with their weird pets. One battalion brought a kangaroo as a mascot, and futuristic vehicles. The AIF had an armor-plated desert truck that the troops called The Terror, the name that the dime novel hero Jack Wright gives to an electric carriage that he has invented to ride across the American West. The Australian soldiers had been raised on the same penny fiction as their British counterparts. Robert's band performed at church parades and funeral services and on marches. At the start of a night march through the desert, they stood in 2 feet of sand as they played their boys out with, here we are again. After a 48-hour sandstorm, they played them into camp with, the end of a perfect day. On 1 April, they performed for the troops by moonlight in a palm grove by the Nile. Even Private Sussman was by now smitten with pride. "Our band," he told his diary, "is at present the crack band of the military forces in Egypt." Robert and his fellow bandsmen doubled as their battalion stretcher bearers, the soldiers who would administer first aid on the battlefield and carry wounded troops to safety. The size of a band roughly corresponded to the number of stretcher bearers required by a battalion, and it was convenient to train them as a group. Captain Cyril Shelshier, the battalion medical officer, taught the musicians to dress and bind wounds, to fashion slings and splints for broken limbs, and to load a man onto a stretcher. The collapsible wood and canvas stretchers were fitted with leather halters that the bearers could strap over their necks to spread the load. They were also taught to carry the wounded without the aid of a stretcher, hoisted over a bearer's back in a fireman's lift, or sitting on 2 bearers' clasped hands. In April, the Australian troops learnt that they were to sail for Turkey as part of an Allied plan to seize the Gallipoli Peninsula, gain control of the Dardanelles Strait, capture Constantinople, and knock Turkey out of the war. "On 11 April," recalled Sergeant Charles Lezeron of the 13th, "we left Heliopolis and marched to the station with the band playing and everybody swinging jauntily, much bucked up by the prospect of immediate active service." In Alexandria, they boarded a filthy tramp steamer and set out to sea, the band performing the Marseillaise as they sailed past the French troopships in the bay. The 13th Battalion soldiers were known for the excellence of their trench digging and their marching, for the speed with which they could load their guns, and for a cool, stubborn spirit known as Hyde. The flippancy of some could shade into a harsh contempt. As they lay in the dark ship crossing the Mediterranean, horse urine dripping onto them from the deck above, they sang to the tune of Onward, Christian Soldiers. "Onwards, ragtime soldiers, fed on bread and jam. For our bloody colonel, we don't care a damn. See our gallant major, strutting on ahead. And our only prayer is, may God strike him dead." On 17 April, the steamer anchored off the Greek island of Lemnos, 60 miles west of the Dardanelles, and on the night of 24 April, the battalion band gave a final concert. The men roared for encores. "Good old band," they cried at the close. In the morning, Robert put his cornet into storage and buckled on the armband that marked him out as a stretcher-bearer. The initials SB embroidered in red wool on cream cloth. At 10:40 a.m., the battalion sailed for Gallipoli. As the ship anchored near Suvla Bay in the afternoon of 25 April, the men of the 13th looked out at the thin beach, the sheer, scrubby rock face behind it. The shells bursting from the mountains, the rifles flashing and snapping in the dust and smoke. The first waves of Australian and New Zealand, or ANZAC, troops had landed on the peninsula in the early hours of the morning and were fighting in the hills, while Allied battleships bombed the Turkish positions from the bay. At 9:30 that night, the soldiers began to clamber down the rope ladders onto a destroyer, from which they were transferred to rowing boats that carried them closer to shore. A few of the men were hit by Turkish bullets before they reached land. The rest climbed out of the boats with their heavy packs and waded to the beach, where the bullets continued to whip down among them. Hundreds of soldiers were wandering about on the beach, having retreated from the front line dazed or wounded. The Turks, though initially outnumbered, had used their superior artillery to inflict great losses on the Australians and New Zealanders, driving the invaders back so that they now held only a broken line of ridges close to the bay. The new arrivals were told to head up the slope to plug a gap in the line. The soldiers of the 13th were under constant fire as they climbed the hill past scores of dead and wounded soldiers. When they reached the narrow, jutting ridges at the head of the valley, they began to dig in. As they dug, they fought, shooting at the Turks across the flat fields between the trenches. The Australians were exposed if they moved even a few feet back, and the Turks were, in places, barely 40 yards in front of them. Above the steady clink of the shovels, the shells screeched. "The noise is hell," wrote Hobson in his diary. The bearers were kept busy from the start. When Robert heard the cry, "Stretcher bearer," he and a comrade hurried forward with a stretcher and a pannier of supplies. Scissors, bandages, dressings, water, morphine tablets. They would staunch and bind an injured soldier's wounds, lay him on the stretcher, and carry him away for treatment. Regimental bearers usually took the wounded only as far as a dressing station or ambulance just behind the front line. But in the chaos of the Gallipoli landings, they had to haul them all the way down the ravine to the shore. Robert and the other bearer would edge through the gravelly gully with their load, dodging bullets and shells from the hills, using their bodies as brakes as they slipped on loose stones. At the casualty clearing station on the beach, which was often itself raked with artillery fire, they handed over the wounded. Then they climbed back up, grabbing at tufts of scrub along the tracks, their hands and clothes snagging on bristles as they picked their way through rocky fissures to fetch the next casualty. In these first days and nights, the bearers worked with courage and tenacity. All around them men cursed and screamed, crazed by thirst or pain or terror. Some of the bearers collapsed from exhaustion as they struggled down the gullies, then rose to carry on. "Stretcher bearers are great," attested one soldier. "They go up and down all the time in the open, carrying the wounded through a withering shellfire. It's magnificent to see them. They are the real heroes of the affair, because they are unarmed and exposed to everything." Private Ray Lingard, a 21-year-old 13th Battalion bearer, explained in a letter to his uncle, "The Turks are waiting for you to just bob up so as to have a smack at you. We stretcher bearers are not protected by the Red Cross, so you see they are at liberty to blaze away as much as they like." The bearers came to symbolize the mateship that was forged at Gallipoli, a spirit of unflagging, selfless devotion that was the kernel of the Australian soldiers' identity. At night, they dug graves for the dead. The bearers slept in the hillside below the ridges, where they were frequently assailed with shells. "One landed within 7 or 8 yards of my dugout, but luckily did not explode," wrote Private Lingard. "It buried itself about 7 feet in the ground. We were trying to cook some tea, but shells kept landing and throwing up heaps of dirt in the air all around us." The troops treated the danger like play, the proximity of death as a wild joke. "I never laughed so much in my life as I did when those big shells were landing," said Lingard. The bearers needed unusual resilience to endure the passivity of their role. They were required to witness savage violence, to step forward to comfort the wounded, while never lifting a hand against the enemy. The official history of the Australian Army Medical Services, observed that the courage required of the stretcher-bearer was of a peculiar and, so to speak, unnatural quality. Not the instinctive response of the courageous animal to attack, but an acquired and conditioned inhibition of the instinct of flight, a deliberate disciplining of the mind and will through the impulse of self-respect. The bearers were servants at once of humanity and of hatred, of the Geneva Convention and of the military command. Unlike other soldiers, they had to suppress their impulses to defend themselves or others. In a letter to his parents, the 13th Battalion bearer, James Dow, described the agony of watching a friend slowly die in the dugout beside him. "What makes us mad," he wrote, "is that they snipe you and you cannot revenge your mates." On the night of 2 May, the 13th was instructed to attack the Turks from one of the ridges at the top of the valley. As the soldiers advanced under cover of fire from the British gunships, they sang Tipperary and "Australia Will Be There," the swell of their voices flooding down the valley behind them to the beach. They fought furiously through the night, digging fresh trenches on the plateau beyond their ridges. But when dawn broke, they found that the battalions that should have protected their flanks had failed to arrive. Exposed on all sides to Turkish shells and machine-gun fire, the men of the 13th were mown down. "It was just hell, pure and simple," wrote a private, "with the gates wide open." Robert and the other bearers ferried dozens of men down to the beach, many with their limbs blown off or their bellies split open. At the 4th Brigade Field Ambulance Station, Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Beeston operated on the casualties. "Some of these are very ghastly," he wrote in his diary. "A shell will carry the whole of the intestines away, others half of the abdomen. Nothing can be done for these unfortunate fellows but fill them up with morphia and await the end." In total, the 13th had now lost more than half of its 934 men and 14 of its 25 officers. The commander of Robert's company, Captain Brash, fell down a ravine on the night of 2 May and broke his back. Major Ellis, the battalion second in command, was hit by a sniper and died the next day. The once-derided Colonel Granny Burnage had been continually in the front line in these first days on Gallipoli. He led his troops into action and steadied them when they wavered. "He is as brave as a lion," said Private Hobson, "and we have grown to love him." General John Monash, the commander of the 4th Brigade, reflected in mid-May, "We have been fighting now continuously for 22 days, all day and all night, and most of us think that absolutely the longest period during which there was absolutely no sound of gun or rifle fire throughout the whole of that time was 10 seconds. One man says he was able on one occasion to count 14, but nobody believes him." The general had come to know the sound of each projectile. The bullet, which passes close by, has a gentle purring hum, like a low caressing whistle long drawn out. The bullet, which passes well overhead, has a sharp, sudden crack like a whip. Our machine guns are exactly like the rattle of a kettle drum. The enemy's shrapnel sounds like a gust of wind in a wintry gale, swishing through the air and ending in a loud bang in a cloud of smoke when the shell bursts. Our own artillery is the noisiest of all, ear-splitting, with a reverberating echo that lasts 20 or 30 seconds. The men of the 13th continued to attack the Turks, and to defend themselves with bullets, bayonets, handmade bombs, neither advancing nor retreating from their positions on the ridge. Of all the troops, the stretcher-bearers made the most forays into the lines of enemy fire. Corporal Harold Sorrell, a Methodist divinity student and one of the 13th Battalion bearers, reported to his parents that month, "There is not a front-line trench in the whole of the field into which we have not been. I have been hit 4 times and have had countless narrow shaves. One morning I had just dressed a man's broken leg and was lifting him onto a stretcher when the sniper's bullet whizzed under my arm and drew blood on the 3 knuckles and entered the patient's neck, fortunately not killing him. Many of the dead lay in a wheat field between the two front lines, swelling in the heat. During an armistice on 24 May, hundreds of Turkish and Allied troops walked into the no-man's land between the trenches to collect the bloated, maggot-infested corpses for burial. The men tied handkerchiefs around their faces to stave off the smell. When the truce came to an end at 4:30 p.m., the Australians exchanged cigarettes and souvenirs with their Turkish counterparts and wished them well. Then the fighting resumed. The Turks blew in a section of the trenches occupied by the 13th on the night of 29 May. There was a muffled roar as the earth rocked. The underside of a cloud glowed red with the reflected explosion, and men were buried where they stood or lay. The Turks then threw their bombs. "Grenades like showers of peas," wrote a lieutenant, "and the noise and the flashes and confusion in the darkness, together with thick curtains of acrid smoke, made this portion of the line a terrible Hades." "The stretcher-bearers worked like heroes," recalled Private Hobson. When Colonel Burnage was wounded, the bearers went quickly to his aid, but he told them to leave him until all the other injured men had been evacuated. After this attack, the 13th Battalion, bearded and scrawny, finally went into rest in the valley. General Monash and Colonel Burnage congratulated the troops on their courage and endurance, giving special praise to the stretcher-bearers. In the official 13th Battalion history, the bearers were described as magnificent without exception, and Robert was one of 11 men in the force of 1,000 who were singled out for the service they had given in the days after the landing. He and the divinity student Harold Sorrell were also lauded for their exceptionally splendid and gallant work in carrying the wounded down from the ridges in the attack of early May, and in risking their lives to gather and bury all the bodies that they could find. The official historian of the AIF rated the 4th Brigade's defence of the ridges above the valley as one of the 4 finest Australian achievements of the war. For Robert, the achievement was very particular. In Broadmoor, every aspect of his life had been regulated, from the temperature of his bath to the location of his tailoring shears. On the ridges of Gallipoli, he was subject to unfettered sensation and danger. Some of the sights and smells and sounds were weirdly reminiscent of the scene in his mother's bedroom at Cave Road, the groaning bodies, the sweet, ammoniac stink of rotting flesh, the descent of the flies. This time, though, it fell to Robert to save the wounded and to honour the dead. The Australians were effectively in a state of siege. 20,000 men were occupying an area less than 3/4 of a mile square, bounded on one side by the ridges, on another by the narrow beach. From their camp in the valley, the men of the 13th looked up at the crest above them, scorched bare by gunfire, and down at the Aegean Sea, pink and yellow as the sun rose, and sapphire at noon. Some of the troops in the valley dug trenches and tunnels, while others were sent to the beach to unload the barges and distribute supplies. They shifted crates of bully beef and cheese, bags of sugar, boxes of biscuits and ammunition. They loaded water onto mules to carry up the hills by night, and wounded men onto boats that would take them to the hospital ships in the bay. Those working on the beach could hear the shrill whistles of the small craft, the rattle of anchor chains, the hiss of steam and the hoots of trawlers, as well as the constant din of battle in the hills and of shells hitting the shore. Many of the men stripped off to bathe in the sea, cooling themselves in the water until gunfire lashed up the foam. In June, the heat in the valley rose to 84 degrees. The men were ankle-deep in dust and constantly pestered by flies. Houseflies were breeding at the manure heaps, blowflies in the bodies of the dead. The flies settled on the latrines and the mess tins, floated in mugs of tea. The troops had only to open their mouths for the flies to dart in. Captain Shellshire had trained his stretcher-bearers in sanitation, but the rate of infection was such that by the end of July, 80% of the men had contracted dysentery, or Gallipoli gallop. The stench of excrement and decay drifted out to the boats in the bay. Hundreds of reinforcements were shipped in to take the places of the wounded, the sick, and the dead. In August, the 13th took part in two further failed attacks on the Turks, in the mountains to the north of Monash Valley, and again suffered terrible losses. The stretcher-bearers were overwhelmed by the task of carrying the wounded to safety. Many were themselves injured or killed. Robert had escaped serious injury in his first 6 months at Gallipoli, despite being hit at least twice by shells and once by a bullet. But in November he contracted hepatitis and trench foot. Rain, snow, and blizzards assailed the peninsula, and Robert's toes swelled, blackened, and burned in the icy water that flooded the trenches. That month the Allies at last decided to give up on the Gallipoli campaign. In preparation for an exit, they instructed the soldiers intermittently to fall silent, to accustom the Turks to an absence of noise in the Allied trenches. On 10 December, Robert's fellow-bearer, James Dow, reported to his parents that only six of the original 13th Battalion bearers remained on the peninsula. The others, said Dow, had been shot off. On 12 December, Robert became one of the 900 men to sail for Egypt on the hospital ships. The rest of the Australian troops were stealthily taken off the peninsula over the next week. The attempt to eliminate Turkey from the war had failed, but the evacuation, at least, was a success. About 10,000 AIF soldiers spent the Christmas of 1915 in hospital in Egypt. Among the white marble columns of the former Palace Hotel in Heliopolis, Robert was supplied with toothpaste and soap in clean pyjamas, and tended by Australian nurses in starched uniforms. He asked that Natty be informed of his whereabouts. Natty was also serving with the Australian forces. The Australia, on which he was a stoker, had taken part in a mission to occupy the capital of German New Guinea in August 1914, and had since covered more than 40,000 miles, chasing two German destroyers across the Atlantic. In the heat of the tropics, the stoke hole grew so hot that the stokers took off all their clothes. The perspiration dripped down their naked bodies into their boots, out of which they poured it in streams, reported the engineer commander. But we kept after the Germans without losing a knot. The journey was interrupted only by the dirty and exhausting business of loading fuel from colliers stationed off tropical islands. Towards the end of 1915, the Australia was sent to patrol the North Sea, where the crew were issued with rabbit-skin coats to protect them from the bitter cold. Natty was promoted stoker petty officer, the equivalent to the army rank of sergeant. He received the news of Robert's ill health on Christmas Day. Robert was discharged to a camp on the other side of the Nile in January 1916, but instead of being returned to the 13th Battalion, was transferred to one of the sanitary sections that were being set up to oversee hygiene in the field. He was promoted corporal, which entitled him to an increase in pay to 10 shillings a day, and gave him authority for the first time over other soldiers. Robert's unit formed part of the 4th Division, which included the 13th Battalion and also a new 45th Battalion, to which half of the men of the 13th had been transferred. From March onwards, the division guarded the Suez Canal and trained in the desert nearby. The men were again plagued by insects in the intense heat. Robert and the other sanitary officers helped to limit infection by burning manure and building box latrines. On 25 April, the first anniversary of the Gallipoli landings, the Prince of Wales visited the camp to watch the division compete at water sports in the canal. General Monash pinned blue ribbons to all the men who had served in the Dardanelles, and red ribbons to those like Robert, who had taken part in the landing. These early recruits would become known as the Adventurers, the Originals, and the Pioneers. Robert sailed from Alexandria for Marseille with the 4th Division's medical section on 1 June 1916, then took a 3-day rail journey north to French Flanders. The British commanders urgently needed the Australians to reinforce the Allied line along the Western Front. After the sand and dust of Egypt, the Australian troops were dazzled by the colour of France in June. The green fields, the blue cornflowers, the scarlet poppies, the tiny white blossoms in the hedgerows. Grateful villagers pressed strawberries and cigarettes on the soldiers when the train stopped at the stations along the track. At longer halts, Australians dashed into the villages to buy chocolate and wine. Behind the lines in Flanders, Robert and the men in his charge built latrines and urinals. They erected incinerators to burn rubbish, manure and feces. They cleaned the streets and billets, supervised the baths in which the troops came to wash, and the laundries that disinfected their lice-ridden uniforms. They tested the drinking water. The sanitary officers urged the troops to bury their waste in shallow trenches or shell holes, or better still, to defecate in pits, pans or biscuit tins covered with fly-proof lids. They told the cooks to wash their hands with soap, to disinfect their implements, to burn food waste, and to use grease traps when disposing of dirty water. Robert was promoted acting sergeant. That month, Robert was recommended for a military medal for his service at Gallipoli, especially at the landing and in May. He was one of the few survivors of the 13th Battalion stretcher bearers, noted the citation, who were thanked by Colonel Burnage and Major Ellis for their services during the first 2 days. In July, the 4th Division was ordered south to the Somme, and at the beginning of August they reached the town of Albert, a few miles behind the front line. The golden statue of the Virgin Mary, on top of Albert's cathedral, had been jolted out of place by a bomb, and the Madonna now pitched forward over the town square, clutching her infant son. From the streets of Albert at night, the men could hear the bombardment at the front line, see the sky flush red with shellfire. Two men in Robert's sanitary section were wounded in an attack. The division was sent into battle on 5 August, with the objective of holding on to the village of Pozières, which had just been won back from the Germans, and the high ridge beyond. The Germans were waging a vigorous counter-attack, in which they shelled the Australians with explosives and shrapnel day and night. The stretcher-bearers and ambulance units struggled to convey the wounded back to safety. Some of the sanitary men doubled as medics, treating prisoners of war and their own troops. At night, sanitary squads went out to bury the dead. On 16 August, after 11 days in the trenches, the 4th Division was sent back north. It had succeeded in retaining Pozières, but at a cost of 1,000 men. The Australian Imperial Force as a whole had lost 28,000 soldiers in 6 weeks on the Somme, more than in the whole 8-month campaign at Gallipoli. Its troops had been exposed to the full force of industrialized war. Both at Gallipoli and on the Western Front, Robert had seen comrades unstrung by the intensity of the fighting. The incidence of shell shock in the 4th Division was particularly high, and the men most likely to succumb to mental collapse were those whose roles were passive. But Robert was still stable. His fellow Broadmoor inmate, Frank Rogers, who had killed his mother in 1904, was also now serving in France with the Clark's Division of the Royal Garrison Artillery. Sergeant Rogers proved a very capable soldier, according to his British Army papers. Honest, sober, hard-working, and intelligent. In Belgian Flanders that autumn, Lieutenant Colonel Sidney Herring, the commanding officer of the 45th Battalion, decided to form a military band. Herring had served with the 13th in Egypt and at Gallipoli, and he had seen how a band could lift the spirits of the troops. On a visit to London in the spring, he had bought a set of instruments, paid for by the men of the 45th. And when the battalion was sent north in October, he launched a search for musicians. A few of the surviving bandsmen-bearers of the 13th had been moved to the 45th, including Ray Lingard and Harold Sorrell, both of whom had sailed out of Melbourne on the Ulysses. But Herring requested that Robert be transferred to the battalion to lead the new ensemble. Robert was known as a good soldier, as well as a fine musician, and his service record was clean. He had served for 2 years without missing any days in the field to venereal disease and without being cautioned for any misdemeanor such as insubordination, drunkenness, or absence without leave. Herring confirmed his promotion to sergeant once he had been transferred to the 45th. Robert was given a cornet, a badge with 3 chevrons and a lyre, and an increase in pay to 10 shillings and 6 pence a day. Later in October, the London Gazette announced that Robert Allen Coombs had been awarded the Military Medal for the courage that he had shown at Gallipoli. Robert asked that a copy of the announcement be forwarded to Natty. Natty, now Chief Petty Officer Stoker, a senior non-commissioned rank, had chosen to remain with the Australian fleet rather than return to the British Navy when his term of service expired. On a foggy day in April 1916, his ship collided with another Allied vessel while on patrol near Scotland, sustaining a 40-foot gash in her side. Luckily, the waters were calm enough for the Australia to make her way back to the mainland for repairs. She sailed again on 31 May, just too late to join battle with the German Navy off Jutland. "It was too bad," complained Natty's fellow stoker, Reginald Stevens. "The men were absolutely sick about it. We had, during the war, done more running than any other battle cruiser in the Navy. And then, owing to an accident, we missed the biggest naval battle by a few hours." For the rest of the year, the Australia continued her uneventful patrol of the North Sea. Robert proved an effective bandmaster, alert to matters of discipline and deportment, as well as musical direction. He sometimes rehearsed the musicians alongside his old band in the 13th Battalion. At the 45th Battalion headquarters, where he was stationed with about 10 other sergeants, he made friends with William Alabaster, a 23-year-old carpenter from East Ham who had emigrated to Australia in 1912. Bill Alabaster led a unit of pioneers in engineering and construction tasks. He was a tall, fair-haired, jovial chap, popular with his fellow soldiers, who had sailed for Egypt on the same ship as Robert and had served with him at Gallipoli. The AIF no longer used its musicians as stretcher-bearers. After the devastating losses on the Somme in the summer, the commanders had decided that the depletion of battalion bands was too damaging to morale. Instead, Robert and the band marched their battalion into the front line, then worked behind the lines before marching out to meet the troops as they returned from the action. The 45th was constantly on the move. It struck camp once every 5 days, on average, during its 2.5 years on the Western Front, and the band sometimes led the way on the marches between billets. When the battalion was resting, the musicians staged concerts for the men. In place of the crazed racket of the front, the raw scream and bark of artillery, the band made sweet, stirring music, summoning the numbed troops back to themselves with plangent, sentimental tunes, rousing martial marches, playful rags. The bandsmen struck notes of innocence, defiance, fellowship, pity, romance, with a sincerity that briefly pierced the Australian soldiers' armour of laconic mockery, their fabled coolness, and hide. In late October, the battalion was sent back to the Somme, where it remained through the terrible winter of 1916-17, being rotated in and out of the front line as the snow gave way to fog and freezing rain. The mechanisms in the men's rifles froze, the bolts jammed with mud. On the coldest nights, hoarfrost formed on the men's greatcoats even as they sat in their huts with the braziers lit, and their breath froze into icicles where it touched the wool of their balaclava caps. There were spells of rest and pleasure. Robert and 2 other sergeants spent Christmas Day 1916 with a French family they had befriended, eating jelly and cream, drinking wine, singing and playing games, before rolling back to camp in the early hours of Boxing Day. In the thaw of 1917, the mud sucked at the soldiers' boots as they moved between camps. The troops trudged through flooded shell craters, in fields strewn with dead men and dead horses, wrecked wagons, scorched and blasted trees. The Germans often targeted the support lines, and the Australians became accustomed to the strangled shriek of a descending shell, the roar and flare as it hit the ground, the sight of a cobber blown to bits where he stood. "We live in a world of Somme mud," wrote Private Edward Lynch of the 45th Battalion. "We sleep in it, work in it, fight in it, wade in it, and many of us die in it. We see it, feel it, eat it, and curse it, but we can't escape it, not even by dying." In the dismal village of Dernancourt, the battalion hid from the German planes during the day in the cellars of ruined buildings, coming out at night to repair roads and bridges and to dig graves. "We hate this hole," wrote Lynch. "We're as mud-stained, wet and weary as the place itself." The British commanders were increasingly assigning the Australians to the more difficult actions on the Western Front, a tribute to the effectiveness of the soldiers and the reason that the AIF suffered a higher percentage of casualties than any other Allied force. The 45th was awarded 37 decorations for bravery at Gueudecourt in February 1917. In June it took part in an elaborately planned action at Messines Ridge in Belgian Flanders, which opened with the Allies detonating £1 million of explosives next to the German trenches, instantly killing 10,000 enemy soldiers. The blast was heard in London and felt across southern England. In the fighting that ensued, Bill Alabaster led the parties carrying grenades, ammunition and water from the 45th Battalion headquarters to the troops at the front line, across open ground raked by artillery and machine gun fire. Herring recommended him for the military medal. The 45th lost 7 officers and 344 other ranks over 4 days of combat. "We're a pretty casual sort of army, all right," observed Private Lynch. "Yet notwithstanding this, the battalion has never lost a position to the enemy, and much of their worth lies in this casual going attitude. They'll stand amidst a tornado of screaming, crashing death and pump bullets into an enemy attack, or attack the strongest held enemy position with the same casual air that they'll chuck or fail to chuck an off-handed salute to the British staff officers on the Strand." Robert and his friend Bill Alabaster went on 10 days' leave in September 1917.